Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Mahalo for tuning in to The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. Back to the table, negotiators for hoteliers and the Hotel Workers Union, Unite Here Local 5, resume talks today over a new working contract, why a rival union rallied in support, and what this could mean on the labor landscape. Controlling the rat population can help save our endangered birds. We hear about new research on rat contraception. And what's this about smart plants? Is there a realm humans haven't tapped yet? We hear from the author of a book about plant intelligence. And high-tech advancements make way for new ways to see the surf. We dive into what makes the new surf film trilogy, New Wave, unique. Tune to The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. Negotiators for Marriott and Kilia are meeting with the Hotel Workers Union Unite Here Local 5 today. Tomorrow, Hilton agreed to come to the table, and Hyatt will return to hash out a new working contract next Thursday. In advance of the talks, a rival union, the International Longshore and Warehouse Union, yesterday rallied to support the labor negotiations. Hundreds of hotel workers paraded through the Hilton property, disrupting the peace and quiet of the resort with their bullhorns, while police and security stood by. The ILWU Local 142 members marched to the Hilton Hawaiian Village from the Hawaii Convention Center, where they were holding a conference. HPR's Mark Ladau talked with ILWU President Chris West just before the march got underway.
We're in convention right now, our once every 3 year convention that was originally planned for the Hilton Hawaiian Village due to the labor dispute and the fact that we're not supporting anyone that doesn't support livable wages and local working class families. We moved our convention to the convention center. So we're taking our delegates and we're going to march from the convention center to the Hilton Hawaiian Village in support of Local 5, Unite Here, but in just support of working local families. You know, tourism's the number one revenue generating industry in the state, and also supports, I think, nearly 300,000 families. And as I'm sure you know, local families are moving out of Hawaii in record numbers because they can't afford to live here. So when maybe in the past, when our unions could have been seen as competitors, we both faced the same struggles, and that's fighting for our families to be able to have the choice to stay home, stay in the place they love, versus being forced to make that decision between where they want to live and where they can afford to live. It's the only way that the message will be heard is when organizations representing the majority of the local working families in Hawaii get together to send a message that our people deserve to be able to stay here. And the only way it's going to happen is if two things: we lower the cost of living and raise wages.
And that's obviously what Local 5 is going to be doing. And my understanding is that ILWU also has hotel workers that are either in contract negotiations or going to be in upcoming contract negotiations. And I'm assuming that it's going to be asking for also higher wages and probably better working conditions, yeah?
100%. Yes, we have contract negotiations going around across the state, whether it's on the Big Island or if it's on Maui. It's all the same, though. And I think this is bigger than just unions. This is just fighting for, you know, in my opinion, the working class is synonymous with local people facing the decision to uproot their families and start roots somewhere else, you know, whether it's Vegas, which is the most popular destination, but we have Hawaiians through Vegas and Washington, California, Texas, everywhere but where they would probably prefer to live, which is here.
If you can talk about ILW's hotel workers, I realize you said this is bigger than that, but the number of hotel workers it's representing and which hotels?
Just off the top of my list, in my head, you know, we have the majority of the unionized hotels on the Outer Islands, but we have nearly almost 9,000 hotel workers working through all the hotels across from the state. But off the top of my head, I wouldn't be able to tell you every hotel. And I really don't zero anybody out, or, you know what I mean? This march is not saying that they're not bargaining in good faith. It's just saying that local families and local people are fed up. And they're at the point now where, if they don't fight for fair wages, these hotels are making record-breaking profits. And did after COVID, and sure, it's slowed down a little bit, or even a lot bit, but there's still a huge portion of profits that they made coming out of COVID that wasn't shared amongst the people that make these hotels successful, which is their workers.
Can you talk about the kind of importance or significance of having these two unions in solidarity? My understanding is that's not historically something that these two unions, I guess at least, have done together or worked with each other?
Yeah, well, in the history books, ILW and Local 5 have been competitors. We represent some of the same types of workers across the state. So, you know, everybody has always seen us, including past leadership, as adversaries and not allies. And under the new leadership, you know, of the both unions, we realized that we have the same fight, and that it's something that, you know, a lot of these corporations are getting together and plotting out how they're going to beat unions. And here we are fighting each other. So the realization is that the only way that we're going to win, we don't have the billions and billions of dollars that these guys have. All we have is us. And we have to put our differences aside and work together for labor and local families in general, both sides.
Okay. Do you think that this is maybe the start of a new working relationship between the two unions and other unions? Or do you think this is specific to kind of the situation that we're in?
No, we actually started a while ago. We started building relationship and talking with each other 3 years ago. But our first demonstration together was in Maui, where our two hotel unions marched for dignified housing for the Lahaina fire victims. And that was the first time that ever, maybe. I'm not totally sure. Maybe I'm not old enough to know. I'm not young, but I'm not old enough to know the whole history of Local 5 and ILW. But I know that Eric Gill had mentioned at the time that this had never happened. You know, we're the two largest private unions in the state. I believe Local 5 has just over 10,000 or 11,000 members around there. And then we have 16,000, between 15 and 16,000 members. So that's a huge demographic. Together, my math's not the greatest, but I think that's somewhere around 27,000 or something like that. Is that right? Yeah, around there, probably 27,000 workers and their families that stretch out across the whole state in industries that cover every aspect of our lives here in Hawaii. So it's something that should have happened a long time ago. But I believe, you know, maybe egos were involved, which prevented it. But it's absolutely something that needs to happen with all unions moving forward. And I believe that it's been happening, whether it's the trade unions or it's the ILW and Local 5. We've all been meeting and talking about how labor has to join together in order to succeed.
That was Chris West of the ILWU Local 142. We also talked to Local 5's Kate Watanabe. It was over the Labor Day weekend that 10,000 United Here hotel workers across the country took part in a three-day walkout. Watanabe underscored the efforts by other unions to support their efforts to hammer out a new working contract. The largest public sector union, the Hawaii Government Employees Association, postponed its three-day convention that was to start at the Hilton today because of the labor dispute. And Local 5 says the flight attendants who are in the midst of bargaining with the airlines have relocated from Waikiki hotels because of the threat of a larger walkout. Here's Watanabe.
No matter what union you're a member of, no matter what city you work in, the changes that we've dealt with related to the COVID era pandemic cuts have really taken a toll on our ability as hospitality workers to provide the service that our guests pay for, expect, and that we want to provide every day. We need enough bellmen to take luggage to the rooms. We need enough front desk workers to check people in and servers. And so these are real core issues that speak to not just the services, but also our brand here in Hawaii, right? Our ability to specialize and cater to our return guests is important. We've got to protect our brand as well, which is so important to our market here in Hawaii. That aloha spirit that we talk so often about comes from the workers, and workers aren't able to provide that if we don't have the tools from our employers to do so.
And then how do you address the soft numbers? Economic reports are out. They're saying in the forecast we're not going to get the Japanese till maybe 2027, and that's a ways off.
Well, look, every single one of these operators that we're dealing with are among the largest hotel corporations in the world. And in 2022, they experienced over $100 billion in gross operating profit. And so they have the ability to continue to make money for themselves and their owners. We want to make sure that hospitality workers have the tools and have their fair share as well. So there's no question. We can look at occupancy, but occupancy is not a good indicator of the health of our industry. We have to look at other indicators like revenue per available room. And RevPAR in Hawaii is among the highest and strongest it's ever been. Our hotels are charging our guests more than they ever did, allowing them to make more at the same time while they're cutting services, they're padding their margins. So while guests are not getting the services, workers aren't getting the staffing, our owners and operators continue to make a very healthy profit. And that's something that we've got to be able to get a fair share of.
And on another labor front, the Hawaii Nurses Union is to meet with management of Hawaii Pacific Health tomorrow to try and avert a walkout on Friday the 13th and a threatened lockout by management, which is believed that it would be the first of its kind in the healthcare field here in Hawaii.
Support for HPR comes from Hawaii Occupational Safety and Health, also known as HIOSH, recognizing September as Suicide Prevention Month. Learn more about risk factors, warning signs, and how to help at afsp.org.
Venezuela's opposition leader Edmundo Gonzalez is vowing to fight for democracy even after fleeing his country, where he's widely recognized as a winner of the presidential election and where there's also a warrant for his arrest. What it would take to get Gonzalez home, that story, and the latest news from around the globe, next time on The World.
Beginning this afternoon at 1.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributor Honolulu Waldorf School.
Have heard of the ongoing mosquito birth control efforts on Maui meant to protect our native forest birds from avian malaria. Now a new pilot project is trying out kind of family planning with rats to save Maui shorebirds. Jay Penniman is with the Maui Nui Seabird Recovery Project. He spoke with The Conversation's Maddie Bender about using a natural extract to put a stop to rodent reproduction.
These days, I would call myself an ecologist. I work specifically with seabirds and their habitats, but we really work to restore the aina and the species that have lived there and the impacts that are not only on the aina, but in the sea, the coral reef habitats that surround us. And my project is specifically focused on restoring seabird populations.
So what are the ways that rodents directly threaten seabird populations and their nests?
Rodents are one of the predators. We basically, you know, back in the day before humans came to Hawaii, there were two mammals. There was the monk seal and the Hawaiian hoary bat, and neither of them predate seabirds. So the seabirds had been here for, not the ones that are here now, but the relatives of these seabirds, the original seabirds that were here, were 70 million years ago. So that's a long time to evolve without having mammalian predators. So you don't evolve any ways of dealing with them, no coping mechanisms. So when people brought rats, mongoose, cats, pigs, goats, all these animals predate seabirds. And they were one of the, and continue to be one of the reasons that seabird populations decline. And rodents are particularly a problem because they can easily get right into the burrows. The burrow species that we work mostly with are procellarids. They're petrels and shearwaters, and they nest in burrows in the ground. So they dig a hole or they go in a crevice that be in like a lava tube, and the rats and the mice, they can just follow them right in there. And they eat eggs, they eat chicks, and they will even predate adults. On Midway, they tried to get rid of the mice recently because the mice started eating the albatross just while they were sitting on their eggs. Rodents are opportunistic. They do whatever it takes to feed themselves. Fortunately, we don't have that much of a problem here, but we do spend a lot of effort on trapping those mammals, particularly rats, cats, and mongoose. And so in the past, we have had to use rodenticides. We can trap some, and we continue to do that, but rodenticides are toxins, you know, they're poison. And when you kill a rat with a rodenticide, it may die and lie there on the ground, and a pueo might come along and eat it, and then a pueo will die. So we are really interested when we heard about this product called Evolve from a company called Synestec that was designed to prevent rodents from being able to reproduce.
It's a really interesting way how it works, right? The product itself.
Yes. It's basically, it's a part of cottonseed oil. It's the element in cottonseed oil that is derived and put into a palatable bait and then placed out there for the rodents to consume. The American Bird Conservancy actually came to us because they knew we had two enclosures on Mauna Kea Hawaii where they were actually set up as mitigation for seabirds that were taken and could be taken at the Kahiawa wind energy facility. So there's 34 wind generators up there going 24/7 or whenever the wind's blowing, and seabirds and other birds can fly into them. And so the company had to do a habitat conservation plan. And as part of that, they built two enclosures that are just under 5 acres in size. And they built one for the a'o, the Newell shearwater, and one for the uapu, the Hawaiian petrel, and then played calls of the birds at night because they come to land at night. And they also put in artificial nest burrows. Unfortunately, the uapu have not decided to come in there. These fences were built 10 years ago. But in that 10 years, the a'o, the Newell shearwater, has started nesting in there. We took over management of the site in 2021. When we took it over, we were using difascinone. And then American Bird Conservancy was very interested in the site. They came to us and said, you know, we've heard of this product and you have two sites. So one of the sites, we could stop doing any rodent control. The other site, we could run these evolved trials. And then we trap rodents in both enclosures and weigh them and determine what sex they are, what age they are. And we will do this over time. It's actually every 2 weeks that we'll do this. We keep the bait in the one area all the time. This product has been tested in the lab, and it's been shown to be extremely effective at basically the reproductive systems of both the male and the female rodent atrophy. They just don't develop and they aren't able to have offspring. But it had never been tested in the field. So now our task is to run these trials. In addition to doing the trapping of them, we trap them in a live trap and then we let them go. After we do it, we may use a little bit of hydrogen peroxide and dye their hair so that we can tell, oh, we're catching the same one over and over again. And when we started doing it, the rodents weren't familiar with the bait and they didn't eat very much of it. We've been doing it for several months now, and the bait disappears every time we put it in. Every 2 weeks when we go back to rebait, we have to refill all of it because they love it. And we use cameras on the bait boxes where the products are kept so we can see the rats going in and out. So it's very palatable. That was one thing that needed to be found out. Would it really satisfy the rodents? And it does. Now we have to trap them long enough to find out, okay, will there be a change in the age structure? So we look at their age every time we catch them. And if we're being effective, we should see very, very few, if any, juvenile rats. It'll just be adults.
And so what kind of time period are you looking at to be able to start to do these preliminary analyses?
We need to catch enough rats over a long enough period of time. And 6 months will be a minimum. We're really looking at a year or more to really be able to get a definitive answer.
And so if this method goes swimmingly, if you can completely eliminate or really tamp down on the numbers of rats in these enclosures, what would the next steps look like?
Well, first off, probably to really go at it, we, the conservation community, attempting to protect seabirds across Hawaii and the Pacific and around the world, really, we're building predator-proof enclosures all over. They're like postage stamp areas where we can get stable populations that then hopefully can move out beyond that. That will be the initial step, is to say, yes, it's been field trialed. We can use this in all of these areas. And then after that, we would be looking at aerial broadcasts across areas so that you're feeding enough rats that you can suppress it. It would be, you know, whether aerial or hand broadcast, but attempting to treat larger and larger areas.
I know you said this has been tested in the lab and it's a natural extract, so you're not necessarily introducing anything like new to the environment, but any knowledge of the impacts on anything that isn't a rat?
Well, it has been tested in the lab on goats, and it's effective on goats as well. So ungulates could be controlled. And in terms of our need to restore the aina of Hawaii, the goats, the pigs, the deer, all of those don't belong here on the landscape. We want to have those. We need them in fenced areas, areas where hunters can go and hunt them and allow the native ecosystems to recover. So doing large-scale broadcasts could be focused in that way to really knock back the numbers of rodents. And we don't know that how effective it would be on the larger mammals, how much they have to get for a dosage that would really work. But it's still not something that's going to cause a cascade of effects like a toxin gas.
And no impacts on the birds' reproduction?
I don't believe it's been at all even considered. The birds don't eat cottonseed. This is cottonseed oil, and it's put into a palatable bait for rodents and mammals, little likelihood.
Yeah, so they're not interested.
No, that's right.
Okay, mammals. So the monk seals, I know, for instance, I mean, things we do on land impacts them. Think about toxoplasmosis. But any, like, how to prevent, for instance, runoff or some of the other ways that monk seals might be exposed to this?
There are definitely more research questions to answer before any of that kind of landscape level activity would happen. You know, right now, we're at the very beginning of it, and we're using it in enclosed areas where we know what's there. And it's being put out not loose on the landscape, but in boxes where it's controlled. And before there would be any kind of landscape level use, there would be much more extensive research done to identify exactly what you're asking about.
That was Jay Penniman talking with HPR's Maddie Bender about birth control for rats. Penniman says the Seabird Recovery Project is working with the state, as well as the owner of the Kahiawa Wind Farm, Brookfield Renewable, to build and extend the fences of the bird enclosure. The goal is to create 43 acres of restored native habitat for plants, seabirds, and snails.
Support for HPR comes from Hawaii Occupational Safety and Health, also known as HIOSH, recognizing September as Suicide Prevention Month. Learn more about risk factors, warning signs, and how to help at afsp.org.
In the darkness, let there be light. HPR is the spotlight that shines upon community voices, fresh ideas, and music selections that dare to venture deep. May you find HPR illuminating, inspiring, and informative. Best of all, you help power this light source that's HPR, an independent nonprofit. Start with a $10 a month donation. Donate today at hawaiipublicradio.org.
While coming through science journals on her lunch break, climate journalist Zoe Schlanger came across a quiet revolution happening in the field of botany. Scientists were arguing about whether plants could be considered intelligent or possibly even conscious. The contentious debate was stoked by recent scientific findings suggesting plants may have individual personalities. They make complex decisions and maybe even draw upon memories. Schlanger was enchanted both by this group of botanists divided by the biggest philosophical questions of their field and by plants themselves. She spent the last 5 years in a deep love affair with plants, which she describes in her new book, The Light Eaters, How the Unseen World of Plant Intelligence Offers a New Understanding of Life on Earth. The book chronicles the latest revelations in plant intelligence and serves as an invitation for readers to reconsider the invisible drama of the green world around them. Schlanger spoke with HPR's Savannah Harriman-Pote about the book.
You published recently this book called The Light Eaters, which is about plant intelligence. And I read the book, I finished the book, and I have to tell you, I immediately upon putting the book down, went to go water my houseplants.
I'm so glad. That's an awesome response.
You just did a beautiful job of opening my eyes to this world of plants that's all around us. You, in the book, describe this kind of invisible drama that's happening all the time in the world of plants. Can you provide some examples of what might be going on in the lives of plants, even if we're walking around unaware of it?
Absolutely, yeah. So plants have this additional sense that we have virtually none of, which is the capacity to synthesize complex chemical compounds. So when I think about plant sensing, that's often the first thing I'm thinking about. Plants can sort of assess their environment with incredible attention to detail, things like moisture gradient, and who their neighbors are according to the quality of light that passes through their neighbors' leaves and whatever the chemical composition of is of their world. And then in their bodies, synthesize the exact chemical compound they need to get whatever they need to get done. For example, plants will often lure insects to do their bidding. Plants are able to do things like summon the exact predator of whatever is eating the plant to come pick off their pest for them. We see this in something as common as a tomato that might be in your garden. A tomato is able to sample the saliva that is coming off of the caterpillar eating it and use that chemical information to understand what species the caterpillar is, or at least what parasitic wasp they need to come pick off that caterpillar for them. And then they will make this compound, this combination of molecules, and release them through their pores, and that will float out on the air and reach the wasp, and the wasp will know, okay, this is where I can come find the exact caterpillar I need in order to lay my eggs.
One of the chapters in the book that really flipped my understanding of plants on their head was about the research that's going into whether or not plants, individual plants, may have personalities. Can you talk about that?
Yeah. I went to a field site in Mammoth Lakes, California, Northern California, where there's these beautiful fields of sagebrush. And I went there to meet a researcher named Richard Carbon at UC Davis. And he's studying the possibility that plants might have consistent personalities that maintain themselves throughout their lifetimes. And he's using animal behavior research to ask these questions of plants. So for the last 20 or so years, animal researchers have been applying personality tests to animals. And normally when we think about animal personalities, it's tested on a sort of shyness to boldness continuum. You have kind of your scaredy cat animals and your very brave animals. And Richard Carbon wanted to apply this to his sagebrush because he knew exactly the chemical composition and frequency of their alarm calls. So plants are able to emit these compounds, these chemical compounds that alert plants nearby to the presence of danger. And he had noticed after 20 years of researching the exact same field, the exact same individuals of sagebrush, that some sagebrush would let out alarm calls at the slightest disturbance. They'd constantly pump out these compounds that say, we're in danger over here. Other plants would only pump these compounds out when the danger was truly very high, when there was truly a lot of pests eating them. And he found that actually it's true that these plants maintain that sort of personality trait throughout their lifetimes, and other plants appear to be able to tell who's who. He saw that sagebrush were more likely to activate their own immune systems, their own defense systems, when they got a signal from the bolder sagebrush and would sort of ignore the shyer, more scaredy cat sagebrush. They kind of occupy this boy who cried wolf place in their little plant society.
One of the things that really comes across in this book is the care of the botanists who have dedicated their life to plants, even if they disagree exactly on the nature of these big questions or what the answers to these big questions might be. I think one possible title for this book could have been something like Plants and the People Who Love Them, because the story is so awash with these different characters who find this natural world as enchanting as you do. And one of those people who you profile in the book may be familiar to listeners. His name is Steve Perlman, and he works with Hawaii's Plant Extinction Prevention Program. He's based on Kauai. I, as someone who's from here, was incredibly moved by how you describe Steve's work.
Yes, I'm so glad you're bringing Steve up. Steve Perlman was one of the people that first brought me into this world of incredible reverence for plants. I was able to meet him while he was doing field work on the Nepali cliffs, where he had previously single-handedly saved multiple species there. And Steve had spent his career doing things like hopping out of helicopters and rappelling down these cliffs to reach plants that had as few as 5 individuals left. They were the most extremely endangered plants. And he would lovingly hand pollinate these plants. And he had such a profound relationship to some of these plants. He described to me the experience of sitting with the last individual of its species and watching it die. He had not been successful in saving it, which is the case for a lot of plants. He described writing poetry for plants, bringing the last specimen of a species to a bar and toasting its life. To him, you don't save species just because they're useful to humans. You save species because they themselves have a right to exist. He really introduced me to what it meant to really feel for a plant.
The natural landscape that we are surrounded by is so rare, and it took, as you say, thousands of years for it to develop as it has. You write, botanists believe one or two seeds made it to Kauai every 1,000 years. On the flip side of that, in Hawaii, we're losing plant species at a rate of 1 per year compared to the natural background rate of roughly 1 every 10,000 years. What was it like for you when you were learning to feel for a plant, learning about these unique lives that they have and the relationships with one another, while also, as a climate journalist, thinking about how imperiled many of these species that we share the world with are?
Yeah. I mean, you brought up the incredible vulnerability of so many plants on Hawaii. And part of that is because the incredible plants you have there evolved with total creative freedom because there weren't any major mammal predators, weren't many predators at all. And that led to fantastically interesting plants that contain no defenses whatsoever. And so then when humans arrived with varying waves of bringing invasive species with them, plants had no chance. I think understanding really what it meant to lose species, that it is this extinction, this extinguishing of truly fascinating biological creativity every single time, did something for my mind as a climate reporter. It really brought this sort of material intimacy to what those losses actually mean, the ways that we are losing not just things that make our lives possible, but many, many non-human creatures are losing what's making their lives possible as well.
This has been a wonderful conversation, and The Light Eaters is truly a wonderful read. Can we get a plant fact for the road before we go?
Totally. I love thinking about the fact that primrose flowers, which are these perfect cup-shaped lemon yellow flowers that grow close to the ground, a researcher recently discovered that those plants will sweeten their nectar by 3 times just in response to the sound of a bee buzzing. Just when they can, quote unquote, hear their pollinator nearby, they will sweeten their nectar. And that researcher plucked off a few petals to see if the effect would change and found that the bee buzzing sound no longer had that effect, which suggests that those plants' bowl-shaped flowers are that shape specifically to take on the vibration of the bee buzzing, much the same way as a satellite dish is concave. And that researcher says that now when she sees a field of flowers, she sees a field of ears.
Zoe, I've so enjoyed talking to you about this topic. Thank you so much for carving out the time to speak with us. It's been wonderful.
It's been an honor to be here. Thanks for having me.
That was Zoe Schlanger, author of the book The Light Eaters, talking with HPR's Savannah Harriman-Pote. Schlanger's giving a talk at the University of Hawaii this Sunday. It's part of the Hawaii Book and Music Festival, which is in person this year. And full disclosure, the festival is an underwriter of HPR.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributors Ulupono Initiative and Ruby Tuesday Hawaii.
On the next Fresh Air, how Elon Musk acquired Twitter and went on to retweet conspiracy theories, allow more hate speech, order massive layoffs, and lose many advertisers and Twitter users. Now, Trump wants Musk to lead an efficiency commission. We talked to 2 New York Times tech reporters who wrote a new book about Musk and Twitter. Join us.
Beginning this afternoon at 3.
For today's Manu Minute, we're in the forest training our gaze on a hardy game bird commonly found on the Big Island, Maui, and Oahu. First introduced in the 1960s, the bird's breeding system has undergone a radical change in the islands. University of Hawaii at Hilo Professor Patrick Hart fills us in on the polygamous, college pheasant. And mahalo to the Macaulay Library at the Cornell Lab of Ornithology for the college calls heard in today's Manu Minute.
Kalish pheasants are native to the mountains of southern Asia and were introduced to the Pu'uva'awa'a area on the island of Hawaii in 1962. Since then, these game birds have become very common in all forests up to about 7,000 feet in elevation on the Big Island, and now can even be found in the Waianae on Oahu and Haleakala on Maui. Male kalij are glossy blue-black with a bright red mask on their face, a white crest of feathers on their head, and a long tail. Females have similar features but are mostly brown instead of black. The loud calls of these birds are very distinctive and sound a bit like the grunts and squeals of pigs. Kalij love to feed on fruits of a variety of plant species, and unfortunately are known to spread invasive plants such as banana poca, strawberry guava, and clydemia into our native forests, with many of these species outcompeting the native plants over time. Kalij pheasants are known to be monogamous in Asia, but in Hawaii, recent studies have shown that their breeding system has changed to polygamy, with one female forming long-term bonds with up to 6 males. These males all cooperatively help the female at the nest, apparently because there's now so many kalij in our forests that there just aren't enough available territories for them to be monogamous anymore. For Hawaii Public Radio, I'm Patrick Hart from the Biology Department at UH Hilo.
Support for Manu Minute comes from Hawaii Forest and Trail, offering nature tours on Hawaii Island with adventures including swimming in private waterfalls, Mauna Kea stargazing, and exploring active volcanoes. More at hawaii-forest.com.
When you imagine how surf documentaries are made, you probably envision a stationary camera on the shoreline and a handheld camera in the water, dodging waves and surfboards. Well, the new surf film, Trilogy New Wave, uses modern camera technology to elevate the art form to a whole new level. Tech like virtual reality drones and 8K resolution cameras provide stunning close-ups and tracking shots that just weren't possible 10 years ago. The film tells the story of a close friendship amongst three professional surfers, Hawaii Seth Moniz, California's Griffin Colapinto, and Australia's Ethan Ewing. The conversations Russell Subiono recently sat down with the director, Andrew McKenzie, to talk about the tech that he used to shoot his feature-length film debut.
Did you start as a filmmaker who became interested in making surf movies, or are you a surfer who's also a filmmaker?
I think probably the latter. I surfed first before I really started making films. I grew up skiing competitively and surfing quite a bit, and it's what I always wanted to do. Honestly, from the second I realized I wasn't going to be a professional athlete, I grabbed a camera, and that was about age 14. I grew up in the Bay Area, and I was always around a lot of tech. You know, kind of when I was in high school, it was like the really big tech boom. So that's always been something that I've been super interested in. And when I was in college, when I was finishing college, I started my company with my two partners, and we were building drones. One of my partners is a biomedical engineer, just crazy brain. And so we used kind of drones as a way to get in the door with a lot of people. Like, that's how I got the chance to work for Taylor Steele, who's one of my biggest mentors and, you know, an absolute legend in the surf space. But, you know, a lot of our work over the last 10 years since we started our company has been commercial work. And, you know, we have a drone services company that does aerials on big feature films. Like, we just did Superman, we did Michael Bay's Ambulance, we did the Ferrari movie, all sorts of stuff. But my focus has really started to shift to long form over the last couple of years. And this was kind of the first big project for me to really kind of sink my teeth into and create a feature length film.
I'm going to guess that drone technology is probably the thing that sets apart maybe modern day shooting of surfing as opposed to maybe what we saw in the 60s and 70s and 80s. Can you talk a little bit more about the drone technology that you use? Because there were some shots in your film where it was clearly an aerial shot, clearly a drone being used, but the precision that you followed the surfer and the wave was very precise and unlike a lot of regular drone footage that you see. So can you talk about the use of this really new drone technology?
Yeah, so when we kind of started our business, there's kind of traditional drones, and that's what you'll see if you go down to the beach on the North Shore. You're going to see 300 of those flying around, right? And what it is, it's a really stable system that has a little bit of a gimbal, so you can orient the camera how you want. But what's really come online in the last few years and what we really showcase with Trilogy is something called FPV. So it's first person view. A pilot flies from the perspective of the aircraft. So they're flying with VR goggles on. Those drones are a lot more maneuverable. They can go a lot faster, and it allows them that precision. But a lot of that is pilot. It's fully manual operation. And so what we did is we went out and we found there was something called the Drone Racing League, but we found all these ex-drone racers, and we started bringing them into the film space. And the one that we worked with on this film, a guy named Blake Sams, is one of the most impressive drone pilots in the entire world. He's won tons of races and done this, but he really took an interest in surfing and really worked with the athletes to understand, because he's not a surfer, but where are you going to be? Where should my drone be? Where can I be closest to you, but also remain safe? And so that was, I think, you know, the first time FPV had been used in surfing. You know, we had used it on a lot of automotive commercials that we've worked on, but it was really the first time it was used in a surf film. And that's what I think a lot of people have really responded to, because it's really unique, and it's a very new way of seeing it. You know, past the drones, we also took a lot of our expertise that we work on automotive work, using car arms and gimbals and those things, and started to attach those things to boats. And so, you know, having the ability to have a stabilized head on a boat really changes things. It's not someone trying to float around in the channel on their shoulder, right? So I think the kind of the combination of those two things are really new perspectives that people haven't gotten. But then, you know, you also have to have your traditional long lens on the beach, a water cinematographer in the water as well, and a camera kind of capturing story and behind the scenes.
With the setups on the shore using long lens, has the advent of 4K, has that helped to be able to, you know, not be so close to the wave, but still be able to zoom in and really get good resolution and a really good composition in your frame when it comes to, you know, following a surfer?
The cameras that we work, they're all RED cameras, and RED actually supported the film and loaned us some cameras to use, but they all shoot 8K resolution. So it's double what 4K is. It's past what the human eye can see. The human eye can see only to about 5K. But what that does is it allows you a lot of space, whether you need to stabilize an image, whether you need to zoom into an image, or just if you want to present an image as high quality as the human eye can see, that's what that allows for. I think past that, there's certain lens technology that we brought to this film that hasn't traditionally been used in surfing, because they're a lot higher end, very expensive lenses. But being able to have a 1,000mm lens on a camera is different. And you think back to The Endless Summer, like they're shooting on a 50mm lens or an 85 maybe tops. Like we have 1,000mm to work with. So it allows you to sit pretty far away. You could be half a mile away and still have pretty close up, medium wide image of a surfer. So I think the combination of those two things for sure has really opened up what we can do as filmmakers in surfing.
Wow, a half mile, that's crazy. Has this new technology maybe eliminated the need to actually get in the water, especially when, you know, you go to so many different types of breaks, right? And sometimes maybe the water temperature might not be ideal for a person to get in the water, or maybe the conditions, you know, are maybe not as safe for someone out there that's not actually surfing the waves. Or maybe, I don't know, maybe there's like sharks in the area.
I think having more angles, it allows you the ability to not have to rely on it. But I think water cinematography will always have a place. Like the water cinematographer that we used lived on the North Shore for a long time, used to shoot with Bruce Irons, lived with Bruce Irons back in the day. And he's an amazing swimmer, but he's brave. You know, where we were in South Africa is very, very sharky, but he was not afraid. And I think for me, if you get a really amazing water shot, there's just nothing that can beat that angle, because it's always going to make the wave look as big as it can possibly be. And it's the placing of viewer. Like if you're in a barrel with Griffin Fall Pinto or Seth Moniz, like, that's a place that 99.9% of the population of the world will never get to experience. They don't know what it's like to be in a barrel. And so I really do think that water cinematography will always have a place in surf filmmaking.
I remember growing up and seeing a lot of shots where there's a handheld, you know, right in the face of the wave as somebody's riding by.
So much of that was pioneered on the North Shore. So
yeah,
a lot of it comes from Hawaii.
In your film, you have several of these slow motion black and white shots of the boys on waves. They're so captivating because there's such a great contrast, right, between the surface of the water and the foam that floats on the water. And then as the surfers, as they're surfing, they're just constantly creating more contrast in the frame. How did you get those shots? Is that more technology or more post-production?
It's more technology. So that is the same FPV technology that I was talking about before. It's the same drone platform, but the camera that we're using on that is a high-speed camera. So it can shoot 400 to 600 frames a second, where, you know, your average is 24 frames a second. So by shooting that many frames, it allows you to slow motion down to the point where you can see every single drop of water. And if you're able to, like did our pilot, if you're able to get close to the action, it's a pretty mesmerizing image. And I think that was something for a lot of people that they had just really never seen, especially from an aerial. People have used high speed for a long time in the water and water cinematographers, but it hasn't been done from a drone. And so that's one of the new things we wanted to do.
And it's so compelling, these shots. They're just incredible visual shots. Surfing is something that so many people feel deeply passionate about. And for many, it's not just, you know, like a recreational activity. For many, it's just the way they live. And I feel like it comes through in your film. What prompted you to want to make this specific film and highlight these kind of specific life moments?
Well, I think that there's been a bit of a void in surfing recently. Like, you know, we get so much of the competition and we all see that. And especially, you know, Hawaii, Southern California, where I live, a lot of us watch that and we love it. Like, we love competitive surfing, but what we don't really get is the other side of it. Why did you come to the sport? Why do you do it? What it is about the ocean that is therapeutic to people? For us, that's why I wanted to make the film. I feel like that's something that we've gotten away from in surfing, is telling real stories and talking about the love of the sport and the love of the ocean. And for me, it felt like it's been so long since there's been a film that really showcased that. It felt like there was a big opportunity and a kind of a void in the space that I really wanted to fill.
It is visually stunning and a great look at relationships between people that come from different places but share a common love. Can you share with our listeners how they can watch your film Trilogy New Wave?
If you're in the continental United States, there's some screenings and limited theatrical that'll be running through September. But for those of you in Hawaii, if you weren't able to make it to one of the screenings we did out there, September 13th, it comes available on iTunes. You can pre-order it now. But yeah, we hope you can watch it and join some friends and watch it on the biggest screen possible. Because I think if you can turn up your speakers and watch it on a big screen, that's the best experience.
Andrew McKenzie, thanks so much for your time this morning, man. Really appreciate it.
Thanks so much, Russell. Appreciate it.
That was filmmaker Andrew McKenzie talking with HPR's Russell Subiono. McKenzie's film, Trilogy New Wave, again, will be available on Apple TV and other streaming platforms starting on September 13th. We are out of time, but up tomorrow, there's been an explosion of e-bikes. We look at what's being done to regulate them on our streets. Got a story you'd like to share? Leave your feedback on our talkback line, 808-792-8217, or email talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org. You can find The Conversation as a podcast on our website or on Google, Spotify, or Apple. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.